Let's take a break with our interview with Libby Larson and listen to Blue Third, two movements.
Thank you.
By our guest today on Calvus and Damien, in the house, Libby Larson.
Okay, we're back. So, okay, we were talking about the music education.
Yeah.
And your experience as you go around these
places.
Yes,
talking to students, often at lunches.
Yeah.
And I ask them, you know, what are their hopes, what are their dreams? What are their fears and what are their frustrations?
Uh-huh. Good.
Good therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Questions.
That's my next question. Oh, sorry.
No, and they're so lovely. Their hopes are to really, really help children to love music. Perfect, simple, profound. You know? Their dreams are to do it really well and really effectively. Their fears are that they won't be able to.
Yep.
And their frustrations are that they are asked to take so many courses for so few credits. Courses that they don't understand if they'll ever use in the classroom. And so I ask them, what are those courses? No, and mostly it's some person's theory about how to teach, or somebody else's theory about how to teach, or three different comparisons.
Methods and materials,
methods and materials, all those things.
Yeah, I did get the education adjunct to my degree, so.
Oh, so you know.
I went through that. It was a long time ago, but I did go through it.
Does any of this ring true?
Absolutely. Absolutely true. Yes, but as I said, it's a long time ago, so things may have changed. But at the time, those methods and materials courses, those practice courses and everything, ended up meaning almost nothing when I got into the classroom, because I did teach elementary school music for 6 years as a composer. Later,
yeah.
15 years later, I got into the classroom and said, "Look, I got to put it up. Now I got to say, this is how you teach. Okay, wait a minute. I better show that it can be done." I learned a lot doing that. But when I had kids walking down the hall who could analyze the pop song they heard last week and at the same time say, "Oh yeah, that's that Bartok second, that's such a cool piece."
Yeah.
Then I knew that something had happened.
Did you have that happen?
Yes, absolutely. That's why I tell that story, is because
that's brilliant.
This was one of those periods of time when I was in a one room schoolhouse. Well, it's not one room, it was three rooms, but mixed grades.
Yeah.
And so all the kids had to read and write. And now some of them were not very good with writing even words.
Yeah.
So they could do graphs or charts. One kid came in and did a piece for his animals.
Yeah.
Which he then went, took our little recorder and recorded them, and with other kids mixed it.
Yeah.
Every kid created a composition.
Yeah, they were composing.
Yes, everyone by the end of that year had composed, had it performed or realized, and recorded it, and we issued new class recording.
Ah, that's fabulous. That. I'm giving you high fives. Well, I just can't hear them on the tape.
It's just that I felt as a composer, I had said a lot, and
yes.
I hadn't done it.
Yes.
And I had better say, okay, composer, go into the classroom and prove that part of this works.
Well, I'll tell you, I did the same thing, because I thought, how can I be doing this? You know, I can't just go around shooting off my mouth. So I've done two things so far. I started by, I had a commission from Apple Valley High School Band.
Okay.
In nice band in the suburb of Minneapolis.
Okay.
And, you know, great, well-trained kids. And the director said, what would you like to do? And I said, I would like to share the concert with all the kids. I want them to write pieces, you know. And not only that, I want them to be part of the piece I write. I want them to contribute to the piece.
Yes, yes, yes.
And bless his heart, Scott Jones is his name. And he said, how, what? And I said, well, you know, let me explain it. And we became a team, and I did... I think probably exactly what you did. I said, first I want to talk to the kids about the elements of composition, which is pitch, rhythm, architecture, and emotional impact, potential for emotional impact.
Okay, right? There you go. Okay.
Next, I want each kid to find a sound, you know, that they can live with for this semester.
Okay.
Then they have to bring it in. And they can tape record it, they can actually bring it in, you know, they can whatever. But they have to then explain to everybody else what the potential is for pitch, rhythm, architecture,
yes,
emotion.
Yes, yes.
So we did that. Then we put the kids into groups.
Okay.
Each one had their instrument, you know, and they had to whittle down, their groups of eight kids, they had to whittle down their sounds to two or one sound. So they had to analyze each other's sounds for all these potentials. We spent a whole Saturday with them alone in the building. They could pick their own space, but they had to come back at the end of that Saturday with the groundwork for their own piece.
Uh-huh.
And they had to videotape the whole process.
Oh, good. Yes. Okay.
They had to videotape the whole process. And they had to sign each other roles. We didn't assign roles. Like you're going to figure. It's just composing. It's like,
yep,
it's just,
yep,
garage band.
Yep.
You know?
In my case, I had them hire the other kids,
yeah,
in air quotes.
Yeah.
You'll be my engineer. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly, you know. And all you have to do is get the kids thinking about music. But it's not thinking about do, re, mi, fa, so.
Exactly.
It's so not it.
Now, we've been talking a lot about music education. Let me have one last question about that, because I have some other things.
Oh, yeah, let's move on.
What has the impact been of music software in schools?
Oh, boy. What grade level?
Say again?
Well, I found that it differs.
Okay.
It differs from school to school and from assumption set to assumption set. But I have found one thing in common, that when a child learns to listen to an interval on a computer, they can't hear it on acoustic instruments. I have found that to be the case almost everywhere now. So much so that now I'm shooting off my mouth about by saying that, you know, when you listen to an interval like do, mi, you know, and it's and the computer is giving you those two tones, what it's really giving you is a precise mathematical demonstration, you know, that may actually not be true. Because when I sing do and you sing mi, and we put them together, and we get what we call a major third, you know, it's not precise. It will never be precise because we're in space. We have different bodies.
Yep.
We get the sound waves.
The character of the sound is
the
different.
The character, everything's different.
How we approach the note and how we leave it.
How everything.
How it echoes in the space.
Everything.
Yes.
Everything, everything. It is literally alive. You know? And it's alive until the space stops vibrating. But when you give a precise, I would say a precise approximation, even though it's an oxymoron,
mm-hmm,
that's what the computer gives you.
Right.
A precise approximation and of mediated sound which does not resonate fully acoustically in space, and when you stop touching the button, it turns off.
Now, what does this do? Does it give the kids a view that will never translate into the reality as a musician, or does it narrow their view?
I'm not sure yet. This first generation of computer ear learners are now reaching the graduate school level, and I have been doing my little research with them, my focus group lunches and in the coffee houses, and you know, and
so good.
I've noticed a couple of things that are beginning to think, I wonder if it's real, you know, if this is now in the culture or not. They can't hear acoustically. The ones who are writing orchestra pieces, for example, they bring me scores, and they're writing things like the prominent voice is the flute in its middle range, written smack in the middle of horns that are at forte.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say to them, what's important here? The flute, of course. And I'll say, but you can't hear the flute. I can hear the flute. No, you can't hear the flute.
But my computer plays it back.
Well, then you bring them into a reading session. The most dramatic was at Peabody a couple years ago.
Okay.
You know, and these kids, and I would say, you cannot hear the flute. You know, I'm the master. You have to believe me. You can't hear the flute. You know, you're not the master. You're the student. You know?
All right.
And then, you know, they're full of ego. And
the so compositional dominatrix at work here. Oh, my God.
So we go into the hall.
You're
you know?
Scaring me.
We're looking at the score, and the orchestra's playing, and the whole line comes on, you know, and this whole section.
Yep.
And I'll look at them, and I'll say, see, you can't hear it. And they'll say, yes, you can. What's happening is
happening.
Brain.
Yes.
It's changing the brain.
Yes.
The brain believes it.
Yes.
The brain believes it can hear it. And so that's one thing that's happening. Another thing that's happening is, this is more on the acoustic, the electroacoustic area, of which is the new 12-tone
right.
in the academy now.
Right.
Is that we're beginning... Yes, I've lived long enough to see the next trend. I can't believe it. is that the young composers who are really much, their ears are finely honed to electronic precision, are having a difficult time grappling with acoustic reality.
Mm-hmm.
No, and that what they want the precision that the electric, that the technology can give them, and they want it out of the acoustic players. And so we go out to lunch, and I say, you realize you're never going to get it. Well, why not? Because you're in a room. You know? Because we're talking about acoustic sound. Because, you know, it's not going to happen. So is this a philosophy, or is this a practicality you're
mm-hmm.
after? Do you know what the quest is? No, and what this means. I'll tell you, what's beginning to concern me on a much more global scale is, if we are training our brains on mixed and mediated sound, the sound waves themselves, you know, are quite compressed. They're really not human.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what I mean? They don't breathe.
Yeah.
They're mediated. And what happens to the yearning for the body, which then affects the spirit? You know, the yearning for the body to be acoustically cradled. You know, I don't know yet, but I'm beginning to feel it in the culture. You know, is that
it's shifting away or shifting back towards?
Shifting. There's a yearning.
Okay.
That
yearning.
I'm beginning to feel in the culture, to be acoustically cradled in sound.
So what drew you to using electroacoustics in your music?
I don't use it much.
But you do use it, which means there's some significance there for you somehow.
Yes, and I'm much... Yes, yeah. It's sociological. I'm trying to understand, since cultures evolve the music they need in order to hear themselves through the language of music...
Uh-huh. That's interesting.
I'm trying to understand, why are we evolving? Compressed electronic mediated sound. You know, is it commodification? Is it convenience? Do we need it? We probably need it. No, and that's why I'm working with it, is I'm trying to understand, what does the need for mediated sound waves you know, and the precision that it offers. You know, what is that need in our culture since we are such an imprecise culture? You know, what are we doing here? You know,
is the precision our new hero? Is that what you suggested?
Possibly. It's possibly.
Are we in a new machine age of the machine age of you know, the clocks of George III? Are we now seeing that, you know, the...
You know, that's a really interesting thought. And if I were to pursue it, I would say, yeah, that's probably it. Is that when a culture... You must study time. I also study time. You know, but doesn't it seem curious to you that when a larger culture is in a real state of flux, there's a focus on the precision of time? yeah, it's probably it. Is that somehow we yearn for the precision we can never have. It's back to the monastery. You know, it's like the aesthetic monk, you know. We place that one guy out there, you know, who lives the perfect life, you know, so that we can all measure ourselves against it. Maybe we're trying to hear ourselves precisely.
It's an interesting thought. I like that.
Yeah.
To work on that too.
Yeah. Maybe we, yeah. Because, boy, we're so far away from hearing ourselves precisely as human beings.
Yeah. I know I'm spoiled by precision.
You are.
Because of so many years of imprecision so far from being close. So many performances, so many pieces not close to what was on the page, not close to what I imagined.
Oh, interesting.
That when I was able to turn to the computer and say, here are the notes in the order, in the rhythms, and the shapes, and the qualities that I had intended, you don't breathe, but by golly, I don't know which is better. This thing where they made an oatmeal of the piece, or this thing over here where they made a nice, you know, precisely stamped waffle with all the edges exactly right.
Well,
I don't know which
is,
you know, sometimes there's no for some of us in position of me of as sort of a underperformed in a lot of ways. You know, you get the one performance and that's it.
Right, and
composer,
it,
you know, you never have that moment, that Parnassus of the one piece that works.
Yes.
Because you never have the opportunity to get people to play it that
way. Yes. And it doesn't develop its own history.
Right.
So there's no performance practice developed with
it.
I understand that. I know what's on my mind. Is that I gave an interview about this opera I keep bringing up because it's my current yoke to bear. The interviewer asked if I was ever afraid of all the risks that I take publicly. And I said to her, well, I don't take risks publicly. You know, she said, well, it's all new music. So she was coming at it from a lens.
Yeah.
But I thought, I'm going to try to answer the question. Where's the risk? And it is, for me, in handing the piece over to the performers. That's where the risk is.
Yes.
Because they can make of it whatever they make of it. And it really hurts to hear a piece completely mangled.
Yes.
It really hurts a lot.
Yeah.
And, but I have come to kind of, you know, I've come to pretty much enjoy the troubadour part of my life because I can be at rehearsals and I can say, you know, let's really try hard for this quadruple piano, you know, and out comes a mezzo forte. A little subtle, you know. And then it's a mezzo forte minus, you know, and it never gets there. But I get to this place of feeling pretty humbled by music again because it's infinite, right? And all we do, I think of myself as just being able to take a good stab at it.
Well, speaking of good stabs at it, let's do a lateral on this. I was criticized when I did my We Are All Mozart project, which was the 100 commissions in 1 year.
Yes, right.
In 2007.
Right.
That I would write 100 mediocre pieces. You write a lot of music.
I do.
How do you keep your music from not being mediocre?
I don't know that I do.
that wasn't the question.
Yeah. Well, you know, every now and again, somebody will take a whack at it and say, you know, it's simple, you know.
Well, that's not. And criticism.
No, I'm not, you know, but you know, it's meant as a, yeah, you know, death stab. And I don't always keep it fresh.
Okay.
And I worry about that a lot. Because I write a lot of music, and it's always for performance.
Yes.
So it's not easy, you know. So I guess I know what I do, and it's really true. And I think I've written about it a little, although I don't know that I have much. As I am constantly listening to people talk, mm-hmm. and I take the rhythmic dictation in my head, then I write it down at home. No, and I try to listen to both inflection and rhythmic inflection and tonal inflection in three languages. And by those I mean verbal language. It doesn't matter if it's French, Italian,
yes.
You know, technological language, and service language.
Hmm.
I know that's probably new news.
Yes, it is.
But regular verbal language, right now, I'm speaking, you're speaking.
Yes.
There's people speaking
upstairs,
you know.
Reflecting that is obscuring the actual meaning of what they're saying up there.
Exactly, yeah. And we're hearing echo, and you know, and. I can tell you, it's always fresh. You know, it's always fresh because people are interacting with each other.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, technological language is not always fresh, but it's pervasive.
Mm-hmm.
There's hardly a space we're in that there aren't at least two constant drones operating. You know, there's always a counterpoint of drone
mm-hmm.
and something.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Rob.
We'll take a break. We're on Calvus and Damien's New Music Bazaar, and we'll be back in just a minute. Our guest today is Libby Larson. Let's take another break and listen to Corker by our guest on K&D, Libby Larson. Thank you. It sure was. That was Corker by Libby Larson, our guest today on K&D.
We just walked in, and it was Rob Patterson who's directing the American Modern Ensemble. I'll tell our listeners that the reason we have all the noise around us and this sort of echoey space is that we're sitting in the Times Center in Manhattan before a couple hours before a concert by the American Modern Ensemble. And it should be a great concert because it's called North Country, and that leads me to my next question to our guest, Libby Larson. And that is, you were a Mid-Atlantic girl. I was a Mid-Atlantic guy. You were Delaware, I was New Jersey. We both went north. Why did that happen?
Well, for me, it was because of my father. I was born in Wilmington, Delaware. My dad was working for DuPont.
Uh-huh.
This is in the 1950s.
Yep.
And then he was drafted into the quartermaster's corps.
Uh-huh.
And so we moved to Chicago, where my dad was a food chemist. And so we lived in Chicago for a while. While my dad invented powdered eggs.
Tasty. And nutritious.
Yes. And then he was hired by the Pillsbury Company to be director of research at Pillsbury, which brought us to Minneapolis.
I see.
That's how I ended up there.
Yep. Okay.
Where my dad invented what we call whack-em rolls, all that refrigerated dough.
Oh, the when
you
hit,
dad,
you hit
yeah.
the things on the side of the counter to pop them out.
Yeah, we were the test family.
The test family. Okay.
So we call them whack-em rolls in our family.
That makes sense.
How about you? How did you?
I was burning out. I was working in New York as a performer. I was at all the avant-garde festivals.
I was doing
a non-profit group where I was organizing concerts and festivals and everything in New Jersey. And I got to the end of the 70s, and I was just a frazzle. And I said, I'm getting out of here.
Yeah.
And
wise.
Moved to Vermont. It was a choice of Vermont or Colorado. I chose Vermont. And never left. I mean, lived in Europe for a while and tried to travel a lot. But,
yeah.
But it was up to there, and I found a difference, and I think we could talk about this probably another time, in how the geography and the time of the place, the space, the time, and everything affects what we do.
Oh, I would love to talk about this.
we can talk about it now if you'd like, but we're getting closer to rehearsal.
Right.
And I know that probably will come up. There's a panel discussion during the concert tonight that will probably come up because the concert tonight is Northern Tier composers.
David
Paulus and you and Elliot Schwartz from Maine and me and and John Luther Adams from Alaska and Rob Patterson also back and forth from Vermont. So,
yeah, great. It's a great group of composers.
I'm intrigued to find out what these pieces will sound like. I have to say that of all the composers whose music I have heard in my lifetime, the one I have the greatest kinship to is John Luther Adams.
Oh, interesting.
Just because he deals with these sort of cloud feels and shapes.
Yeah.
Although I write a lot of classical shapes, I also have pieces that are that. And those are my real pieces.
Wow.
Those are pieces that are my, how I direct myself. But this is about you.
That's all right.
This is about you.
I'm turning it back to you.
Oh, I had one more question that relates to the prolific thing.
Oh, yeah.
Is there anything you won't do?
Oh, yes.
If somebody commissioned you and said, I want this... You know, what wouldn't you do? What would you say? No, I just can't do that.
And I have done that more than once, more than 10 times. I don't write liturgical music very well, mostly because I was a Catholic mystic. No, before the Vatican II Council. So I tend to run into trouble with theology, so I am very, very careful about what's asked of me if I'm writing for church service, and I really don't write, I'll do a whole liturgy, but specific anthems for specific days, it's just, no. I also, there are, people want music for many reasons, I tend to really work well with people who are interested in the it of music, and tend to shy away from people who are interested in having music to enhance them as a person somehow, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. There are also, people are always coming to me, and I'm sure to you, with ideas for operas.
There is that.
And, you know,
I have this libretto, and I'm sure you could write the songs to
yes,
it.
Yes, the songs to
the
it.
Songs
or, and this is the hardest thing to do, a person who really has the funds to commission at a high level an opera, but it has to be a specific opera with a specific subject. And it's just not. And that happens because I write a lot of opera. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you do.
And I love to write opera.
For our listeners who are interested, LibbyLarson.com has a complete list of works, samples, availability, and everything else. And if you want to be shocked about an American composer who is powerful and prolific, go there and look at this stuff because it is a remarkable site. There's writings there. There's a whole array of stuff on the site, including, as I believe I started this interview, a FAQ, Frequently Asked Questions, which asks all the questions that I couldn't ask today because you've answered them already.
Sorry.
Except this one. What have you always wanted to be asked?
You mean to compose or a
no,
question?
No, to talk about. A subject that you really, really has been on
question.
Your mind and nobody ever bothers to ask you.
And really wanted the straight answer of why you write music?
No, they don't ever want a straight answer.
No.
They want a packaged answer, really.
Right.
They want a commodified answer
to
get back to
them. They want a commodified answer.
Yeah.
They really don't. And I'm sure you've had the experience, you know, you begin to say it and then it's like... Phew,
so what is that answer you want to say?
Because there's no other way to communicate what it's like to be alive that I can think of. But you must think and sound first.
I do.
So do I.
Yeah. And it doesn't have... I mean, people talk of music as language, but that language, although it is among people conversant in some ways, does not communicate objects or philosophies or theories. It doesn't do those things.
Right.
You know, we can't express a formula in it. We can't express a sonnet in it. We only can express itself in it.
Right.
And that is hard to convey because it immediately goes into that world of so what? You know, you're not doing. If nobody understands it, why are you doing it? Are you just expressing yourself?
Right.
Which
so
is a thing I hate.
Which is a commodified perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Like so what? You know, people that I've found who really get this are really high level mathematicians.
You've said that before. That the mathematicians that high level mathematicians
high level.
Understand because they're not producing anything.
Yeah, they're
that
doing
they,
the same thing we are.
Yeah,
you know, and it's so beautiful. You know, and it is also it's essential. We have to have it, or no. But yeah, that people ask the question, but they really don't want to hear the answer. That's it. No, I guess maybe we seem insane.
It's true, and I think I don't know. How do you know what you look like when you compose?
No,
I don't. I have
no idea.
I have seen myself compose.
Ooh,
once.
What do you look like?
I look like the person I never wanted to be. I look rumply and distracted, and my eyes don't stay still. They're constantly like I'm like in REM sleep, only awake.
Oh yeah.
And it's ugly. It's an ugly process. It's really work. It's like working on something you don't want to do. It's that kind of. That's how I look.
I'm glad you brought that up. When my daughter was a teenager, when she was real rebellious. And she would always just say, "It's your face, Mom. It's your face," which was just like, but maybe that's it. Maybe she'd be off doing some talking away, and I would be composing. No, I haven't seen.
It's dreaming awake, and that's not always a pretty sight.
No, it's not, is it?
Yeah.
I'm sure I must. Wow.
I don't want to see it again either. I just experimented once with sticking a video camera there while I was working and forgetting.
We do. We must look. We must look insane.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
I think so. Libby Larson, thank you for sharing insanity for a while here on Calvo's Stadium.
And we'll wrap up now with final piece of music by Libby Larson, sections 1 and 4 from Blackbirds. Until next time, Calvus and Damien, in the house. Blackbirds, Libby Larson. Thank you.